You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rendezvous with a Writer, where readers and writers meet.
And story
is everything.
Welcome. We're the hosts,
Jim and Bobby Bell.
And Bobby Bell, and that wonderful music that starts us and closes us with every show was courtesy of the Hot Texas Swing Band. And the name of that tune is Hot Texas. And we're delighted that you're with us again this week tonight.
That's right. And we have a special guest.
We do.
And who's our guest?
I know you did. Our guest is just joining us on the screen. If you're watching on Facebook Live, our guest is Gretchen Sherrington. And Gretchen, where are you tonight? Where are you joining us from?
We live in Portland, Maine.
Right, okay. In Maine. All the way on the other side of the country.
The other Portland.
Right. The other Portland.
So Jim has a little something to say about Gretchen, and then we're going to be talking about
her. Right into it. Yeah. That's right. Gretchen Sherrington is the daughter of Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Richard Eberhardt. She grew up around literary icons from Robert Frost to Anne Sexton to James Dickey. Gretchen chose a long career in business, advising hundreds of CEOs on how to transform their companies into places where both business and people could thrive. We're talking about her first book, Poetic License, A Memoir, winner of the first runner-up for the 2021 Eric Hoffer Award and was a 2021 Four Award Indies Finalists. Join us tonight from home in Maine. Please welcome Gretchen. Glad to have you here, Gretchen.
Thank you.
And you know, when we were talking the other night, right. and you had talked a little bit about the title, and do you know, Gretchen, today I must have written four times that the title was Poetic Justice, when it's not. But we're going to talk about that later.
Well, I'm glad you held the book up, because that's a picture of my father and me. Yeah, when I was 3 years old.
Yes,
on the cover.
Yes, I'm still trying to learn how to use cameras and
you're doing well.
Have things straight in the camera. So, Gretchen, welcome. And why don't we kind of get started with you telling us a little bit about yourself?
Well, thank you. First of all, thanks very much for having me on. It's really been fun to get to know you and also to listen to some of your episodes. It's a really fun show that you have here. So hopefully we'll laugh as well tonight. So I grew up in a literary family, and really, you know, as you read off the book cover, I was surrounded kind of by really famous writers my whole life. The first 20 years of my life were just infused with poets primarily, but also novelists and other kinds of artists. But I really chose a different path. And so I went into business for 35 years, and it's not completely inconsistent, because both of my paternal grandfathers were businessmen, and you know, I saw business people, but I think it was as much in reaction to my family as it was in sort of emulating other people. And you know, I didn't really start writing seriously until I was in my 40s. But I had always kept journals from the age of 5. I had diaries. I wrote down every detail of what happened every day. More in my 30s and 40s, I started using those journals to kind of figure out what I thought about things. And So I have an older brother who's 5 years older than I am. My parents were also older than most parents. My father was 47 when he was married, and 37 when he was married, and 47 when I was born. My mother was 10 years younger than he was. Mm-hmm. And back then, that was definitely older than sort of normal. So I grew up with parents who were not really typical, in a sense, to the parents of my friends. So that's just a little bit about kind of where I came from.
Yeah. And you moved around a bit. What was fun in the book is some places that you lived were places that I had a connection to, or always hoped to have a connection to. And you were kind of on the East Coast, then the West Coast, and you were in Washington, D.C.
Yes.
And then your dad was at Dartmouth. And so you had some travel experience as a kid. And how was that each time you had, you know, you landed in a new spot?
Right. I think it was actually a lot harder for my older brother than it was for me, because by the time my father was sort of chasing tenure, right? So he got his first college teaching job at the University of Washington, and that was when I was a toddler, essentially. And so for the first 4 or 5 years of my life, we were going from campus to campus every year. And I think that was harder on Dickon, because he had to make new friends and change schools and all of that, whereas I was just toddling behind my parents. And, you know, they always made it fun wherever we lived. So as far as I was concerned, as a young kid anyway, it was just fun, you know, wherever we were. But then my father, you know, his really, really first big job at Dartmouth, you know, he said he wouldn't take a job unless they offered him tenure track, because my mother was really tired of moving around. So we moved to Hanover, where he started teaching at Dartmouth. However, 2 years later, he got invited to go to Washington, D.C. To be U.S. Poet Laureate under President Eisenhower, and then was picked up for a second term by President Kennedy. So we spent 2 full years in Washington, D.C. living there. And that was really quite an experience, too. It was just my parents loved it. There was all this glamour, you know, around the president. And my father's office was at the Library of Congress. You know, they were invited to Kennedy's inaugural because Robert Frost was reading his poem. In fact, we got our first TV that year so that Dickon and I could actually watch what was going on while they were there in person. And then we came back to Hanover. So I was there from, say, I can't remember now, fifth grade, I guess, on. But then I left for a year in Switzerland. In boarding school, which we can talk about later if we have time, but another kind of opportunity for me to see the world a little bit.
Let me ask just a quick question about Dickon. He was in boarding school. Was he in boarding school all through junior high and high school? And
all of high school, he was in boarding school, and then he was in college. So in a lot of ways, I felt like I was sort of a single child. I mean, we were very close as kids, but then as I was growing up, he was away and I was with my parents on my own, you know, obviously. So it was, you know, he's 5 years older than I am. So it was a little bit of it was almost like having sort of two different family experiences.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about the backstory? I'm going to hold this up again. So for those that are watching, I'm holding up the cover of Poetic License, a memoir. And if you're listening to us on audio, you know that that's what I'm doing, is I'm holding up the cover. And Gretchen, tell us a little bit about the backstory to this really fascinating read to this book.
Sure. Well, I think where we need to start really is that my family was very public. It was an outward facing family. There was a very high priority put on social life. And so both my parents were just incredibly generous hosts. And as I said before, they really enjoyed having people around. So, you know, there wasn't as much focus on sort of the family unit, you know, in the way that I think my own family was when my kids were little and stuff. And my father was famous. So, you know, there were just a lot of people around all the time. I, on the other hand, was much more inward facing. I tended to, I lacked confidence. I had all whatever the issues were for me as a little kid. And so I spent a lot of time listening and watching and sort of sitting on the outskirts, looking in. And I didn't always feel, and particularly as I got older, didn't always feel like what the public's view of my parents and our family by extension was really my lived experience. There was sort of a difference there. And that dissonance became stronger and stronger over time. And I really, as I became, you know, as I sort of got into my 30s, mid-30s or so, I really wanted to try to figure out what was real, you know, how could my experience of my family be sometimes what seemed so different from the public's view of my family. It looked so wonderful. It looked so, and it was, people came because it was fun. Mm-hmm. And there were, you know, incredibly lively conversations and other famous people there. And so really interesting, smart people in the room to talk to. And I think it, actually the epitaph in the book comes from Rachel Cusk, who wrote the Outline trilogy, just fabulous writer. And I used it because I think it really spoke to kind of, you know, the backstory of, and she says, and if there's one thing I know, it's that writing comes out of tension between what's inside and what's outside. And to me, that kind of, that statement mirrored what I was experiencing in my family, the tension between what was inside our family and what other people thought from the outside. So I think, you know, I think poetic license for me was a opportunity and almost a calling, you know, for me to kind of rectify or reconcile the differences between what I viewed and what others viewed. Mm-hmm. And that took a long time. That was not an easy process. It took me 20 years to get this book out. It was revised at least 100 times. I went through, I gave many times, but always picked it up again. You know, there was something compelling me to sort out what had happened, what it meant to me, and how I might go forward, you know, to become, have my own agency in my life as an adult. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the backstory.
Is there anything else you'd like to read from the book for us?
Oh, sure. Like, yeah, I could read a page and a half or something.
Yeah.
Give listeners a little flavor of the family.
Yeah.
The scene. So this is from the second chapter, and you know, I'm kind of 5 years old, 6 years old, 7 years old, somewhere in that time frame. When I was a little girl, I sat cross-legged on the hardwood floor in the living room of our house in Hanover, back pressed against my mother's bare legs, listening to Dad read his poems as his words wafted on the slip of his pipe smoke and crowned his bald head. Our living room was full of people, always full of people, visiting writers and literary critics, neighbors who lived on our short street, handpicked college seniors from Dad's popular poetry seminar, Mum's friends from her downtown pottery class. The long room could seat 20, 30 in a pinch. Dartmouth students and Mum and I could sit on the floor. My parents collected friends in big bunches, the way I gathered Queen Anne's lace near our summer place in Maine. Their friends came to hear my father's latest poems or to request their favorites. All eyes were on him. It was his voice that mattered. Even our dachshund Star circled her tail 3 times and quieted on the floor beside me. If I could only live at the pitch that is near madness, my father would read, when everything is as it was in my childhood, violent, vivid, and of infinite possibility. Madness, violent childhood, possibility. I didn't know what the words meant, but I felt their importance in the sadness I heard in his voice, or later in his sudden delight at their brilliant beauty. I absorbed the rhythm and cadence of his lines, leaning toward him on the uplift of a phrase I especially liked, and back against my mother's legs when he finished. Poetry was the daily music of my childhood.
That's great. I can remember that from reading that in the book, and I thought it was kind of a very striking.
You're able to take the reader just as Jim is also saying. I found in your memories of those moments that we are right there. I love that star, you know, the tail, and I can, you know, you're able to capture so many details. I think back to being probably that age, and I can hardly have the detail in my head of anything, you know.
Well, there are techniques for memoirists to sort of remember things, and go ahead.
Yeah. Well, some of the details there, as I hear them read, did you supplement your memory of that by going back to your journals maybe had caught that moment in a journal?
I did. I use my journals a lot. I now have to go burn them.
And why is that?
So my kids won't ever see them. But they were a treasure trove for me, just as my father's literary archives at Dartmouth were, which we'll get into later. But they were really a source of validation sometimes, correction. You know, I would look back and say, I would find that something happened actually in the summer when I had remembered it in the winter. And they were very, very helpful to me as I was writing that. And then I think also, just as you, any memoirist I think knows this, that, you know, as you write more and more, particularly if you write it over an extended period of time, as I did, memories keep kind of flowing back. You know, you revise the scene again and you say, Star was there with us, you know, and he would circle around and sit next to me. So I think a lot, we don't have to remember everything to write a memoir, but obviously the more detail we can impart, the better it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's true. You know, it takes a lot of discipline to write in a journal, particularly every day. I mean, I've tried it, and many times I've failed, you know.
No, I agree. I don't do it anymore, but I think, you know, when I was little, I think it was a way for me to kind of have something of my own. There was so much focus on my parents that this was something I had on my own, and I could protect, and, you know, I could say whatever I wanted to say. As I got older, whether it was particularly in my sort of young adulthood as a new mom, as I started going into the work world, they became really important for me in terms of just processing what was going on, as well as remembering things. Mm-hmm. And I didn't keep them every day at that point, but I did, you know, write quite a few. I have a couple boxes of journals. So
have anything. We're speaking with our special guest tonight. We should begin to feel empowered to become writers, you know, from all this wisdom that we get from writers.
Can we write?
We should.
We probably have 200 revisions instead of 100.
We're having a delightful conversation with our guest, Gretchen Sherrington. And one more time, I'm going to hold up the book, because if you are wanting to know how to find it, you can find it on our Out West Shop affiliate page, to bookshop.org, and Sam at LA Talk Radio is going to tell you a little bit about that. Hold on, don't go away. Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shop's bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com, find books and CDs on the menu, choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer with Jim and Bobby Bell and special guests, Gretchen Sherrington.
We're going to change topics just a little bit. You did mention a bit ago about the career that you developed for yourself. And I'm really interested in knowing about how your career advising powerful men, because you were working at very high levels within corporations, connected to this literary world that you were immersed in when you were growing up. Were there connections?
Yeah, this is a great question, you know, and I don't know that anybody's ever asked me that before, so kudos to you. I think for a long time, it seemed like, again, there was sort of dissonance between, you know, what my path might have been if I'd gone on to be a writer at the age of 20 or 25 or something, and what I ended up doing. Now I can really see the connection between the two. But, you know, I was a non-traditional management consultant. I have an MBA and I, you know, got some of the things that you're supposed to have to be a consultant, but I didn't go to JP Morgan or one of those sort of management consultant mills that, you know, turns out hundreds of them. I think this came from my family, was really interested in the human side of companies, or really organizational systems. So in my young adulthood, I got a management job in a healthcare organization, and I ended up being the CEO of that. And that was a place where I started to kind of think about people in systems, whether it was a family system or an organizational system. It could be a religious system. It could be a governmental system, et cetera. But I thought about systems a lot. And I was most interested in sort of figuring out how people could change systems in a way that wasn't traumatic for other people, wasn't traumatizing to those that were in them, because I'd gone through kind of a traumatizing professional experience. And, you know, I just thought there's got to be other ways to do manage change than how this particular process was managed around me. And so for that to happen, I realized once I started consulting that it really, what mattered was the people inside the systems. They needed to change in order to change the system itself. And so, you know, it seems very simple when I say it, but it took a little while to kind of thread that needle. And what was interesting to me was that change could come from anywhere in the company. Let's say it could come up from the bottom, sort of bubble up from employees. It could happen in the middle, or it could come down from the top. But another thing that I learned in my family was that the power was at the top. And in my family, the power was with my dad. I mean, he's the one that people came to see. We frequently delayed dinners or anything that the family needed to do because he was writing a poem. And so, you know, I couldn't articulate this with words necessarily while I was growing up, but as I look back on it, I began to see how, you know, power was sort of concentrated in the top of organizations, whether that's father or CEO or whatever. And I was attracted to do my work there because I just felt like, you know, they have the opportunity to influence the system if they want to. And I wouldn't have to deal with sort of, you've been in business, Bobby, I know, and, you know, I wouldn't have to deal with sort of the bureaucratic machinations of committees and departments and all that. You know, if the CEO shook my hand and said, let's do it, you know, we did it. And so, once I was out on my own and sort of trying to find clients and build up this business, I ended up really spending most of my time at the top of organizations. And some of those, and this is 1980s, 90s, 2000s. So almost to a one, they were all men. You know, the CEOs were all men. In my last 8 years, I was working almost exclusively with female CEOs, but in the beginning, it was almost all men. And so they also kind of gave me an opportunity to look at my dad differently, to sort of, you know, I learned so much from them. And I also felt so privileged to work with them because they trusted me. Somehow I was able to inspire their trust. I became a confidant for them. And I ended up hearing so many things from them that were real human frailties, weaknesses, challenges they were having, stories from their past that had been really traumatic or problematic, whether with a parent or a sibling, or in some cases, I was working in executive education programs at Harvard and Dartmouth and Columbia, and I would be with people from all over the world. And, you know, I'd be working with a CEO who had fled Afghanistan, you know, and had really had incredible lives, you know, that were really hard. And they were struggling to sort of integrate that into who they were as leaders. And so, long story short, you know, I came to be good at helping them really, I came to be good at providing the space for them to open up to those things and to put tough stuff on the table and really look at it and try to move forward. And so what I learned from them was that, unlike my father, who really, I mean, he was a great poet and he wrote amazing poems, and he wrote a lot of not very good poems too. And he did not, he really didn't like feedback from his editors, nor from my mother or me or anything. And, but here were these guys who actually wanted feedback, you know, and they wanted to improve who they were as leaders or as human beings even. And this again was a sort of theme of Marshall Goldsmith's too that I picked up and used for years. And so you know, it was sort of interesting the way my family helped me kind of see things in a humanistic kind of way, and then the CEOs or executives helped me kind of see that there were different ways that people in power could behave. And I admired a lot of them, you know, and respected what they were, even if they, I mean, none of them were perfect or anything, but they were trying, you know, really hard to sort of work on themselves. And so, and then the other thing that was sort of interesting as I look back at it is that there would be moments in a big meeting, let's say, where the CEO would say the perfect thing at the perfect time. And his wording was poetic almost. I mean, I could see the poetry in these executives as well. And, you know, you could feel it in the room that the emotion would shift because of something that they said, and they said it so well. And that was also just really kind of thrilling to see, because it was not something I experienced in my childhood really at all. It was, you know, my childhood just felt more like a party, basically. And, you know, again, 80% of it was fun. So anyway, I do think that there is a sort of union between these two things. But it has taken me a while to be able to articulate that.
Well, you probably encounter one or two who would say to you, "Who do you think you are? What's your background to tell me how to run my company?"
Yes, yes, I certainly did. And I had some of the experiences that women still have of, you know, being pushed up against a wall or, you know, taken advantage of very minimally, because I wouldn't have allowed it. But you know, some of that happened. I sometimes, you know, clients would sort of throw me into a situation without properly preparing me for it, kind of to see what I did,
what you did,
rather than partnering from the beginning and helping me know what the dynamics were and what I might run into. Yeah, there were some of those, but the ones who I ended up working with and developing really long-term relationships were often, you know, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years sometimes. You know, long, really important and deep relationships with them. And it was great. I really learned a lot from them.
You tell a story that was really riveting. You give an example of an appointment that you had. You went in to meet somebody for the first time. And he was very, very friendly, very courteous, and a professional, of course, but he said, you know, do you mind if I take off my jacket? And he really was very authentic and vulnerable with you. And, mm-hmm. and you were just meet, you know, you were not consulting yet. He was,
right.
he shared, it was very interesting to me, that episode, because he talked about that they'd had other people in that had tried to help them. And it really came down to one major staff member that he considered to be very valuable in the skill level that he had. Yes. But he was really hard to work with. And he didn't want to let him go. But even he himself is this, you know, everybody was having a hard time working with this individual. Right. And I thought, wow, for a CEO to go in right away with somebody and share at that level with you, I could only think that part of what would be readable in you would be a comfort. You were around so many famous people for so long, whether you really, you know, you would be,
right.
mm-hmm. you wouldn't be intimidated necessarily. Yeah. And certainly in your career, the more success you had and the more, you know, opportunities sure. you had, you developed that too, but that you were already very comfortable in situations that other possible consultants would be like, nervous about, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. I think you're probably right. I wasn't intimidated by them mostly. I mean, there were a few that sure. intimidated me, but sure. But yeah, I guess I felt like they were, he treated me very much like a human. I was yep. going to treat him like a human.
Yeah,
and that was a sort of pivotal client for me. He was the CEO of a bank, and he was really trying to make change in his company. Mm-hmm. And I remember leaving that, and I think this is in the book, but I remember leaving that meeting thinking, what do I know about banking? I don't know anything about banking. I have a bank account. That's about it. But mm-hmm. I didn't need to know a lot about banking. What right. I needed to know was how to help him figure out where he wanted to go and how to get there.
Right.
And obviously I ended up working with a lot of banks and served as director of a bank now. And you know, but that's just sort of more experience base over time. But at that time, it struck me as odd that he would be so trustworthy of me. But at the same time, I was thrilled by it because I felt like, you know, and he's the one who, when I shook his hand, he said, do I need to write a contract out or anything? He said, no, you know, mm. you shake my hand, my word is good. You know, let's do this thing. And
yeah.
Those were the great clients, of course, because they just paid you as you, built them or whatever. They didn't need a lot of paperwork, et cetera. They, that was the other thing that was nice about working with CEOs. Again, mm-hmm. if they said you were hired, you were hired.
And, hired.
So anyway, and it was a different era too. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that probably can't get away with that quite as much now, even in smaller mm-hmm. companies, but mm-hmm. it was great.
Do you have a question?
Well, you know, we're moving right along here. I thought maybe we should ask a little bit in the process area about the research you did on all those files and letters that your dad had.
Yes. Yes, I often hear from people who are writing memoirs that they are trying to create a book out of one letter that their grandmother wrote to their grandfather that got preserved, for 100 years. And they're trying to create a whole story or maybe a novel, out of this one letter. And meanwhile, I had 50,000 letters in my father's literary archives yeah. at Dartmouth, 175 boxes of them. And when I decided that I was sort of becoming serious about wanting to write about him, which I was in my mid-30s ish, I mean he was very much alive and everything, and I told him I was writing about him, and he thought that was marvelous. I was trying to figure out how do I get to know him better, and I just thought, my goodness, there's all this material at Dartmouth, and I lived a half an hour away, so it was an easy drive up there. And the librarian there, this was not cataloged as yet. So the librarian, I think because this was such a big gift that my father had given to Dartmouth, was very generous with me, basically gave me space, a desk. He said, you can use these materials any way you want to until they're cataloged. Once they're cataloged, I had to leave my credit card, my license, and, you know, everything was hermetically sealed. But so I was just pawing through them, and I couldn't figure out how I would ever get through them. I just sort of allocated my Monday mornings. I don't know why Monday morning, but that's what I did. And finally, it took me a little while, but finally I figured out, you know what? I don't really need to go back and study the 20s and the 30s. I want to know what was happening when I was there. You know, the poets that I grew up around and knew personally as a kid and then as an adolescent and a little bit, you know, as a young adult. And so I sort of wrote out a list of the ones that I was particularly interested in. And they were all alphabetized, thankfully, and by year. So I could follow a conversation between my father and Robert Lowell, let's say for 10 years or 20 years, and remember the boat trip that I was on with Cal Lowell and my father. And, okay, here's the correspondence that surrounded that boat trip. And it might not have mentioned that I was on the boat, but it had all kinds of anecdotes about what they had talked about or you know, what they were looking forward to do later. And one thing I mentioned to you the other night, but that is unusual about this archive is, and I would say that Dartmouth, from what I understand, has about the most accessible literary archives of any university in the country. It's all online. It's very easy to get now. But, you know, what was interesting was that my father kept carbon copies of every letter that he wrote. So you have the entire conversation. You don't just have the letters coming into him. You have his response. And he wrote, you know, we chatted about this the other night, but, you know, he wrote long, single space typewritten letters, pages of them. And I mean, the volume was just incredible. And it's hard to imagine that now.
I know. Who does that? They're texting and email. Who's printing their email? You know, will happen? You know, it's one of the big things I really worry about for future researchers. And, you know, it's like, where are you going to?
Did you find something?
I mean, I was sort of going to get to that where, you know, there was this huge volume, but at the same time, I did kind of have a mechanism or an organizing principle by that time. And I just sort of honed in on the poets that I was most interested in, or the issues in my life or timings in my life that I wanted to read context for. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there were several things that were really illuminating to me. One was that my father and Allen Ginsberg were very close friends. Very different people, but really had a strong admiration for each other as literary figures and writers. And Alan, to the time that my father died, would say that Dad really launched his career because he went from the East Coast literary establishment that he was sort of already a part of out west to check out the beat poets in San Francisco and Seattle, and met, you know, 30 different poets. But one of them was a very young Allen Ginsberg who read Howell while he was out there. And he came back and wrote an article for the New York Times Magazine about the beat poets. And after that, all of a sudden, they were starting to get published. None of them had been published before. Through his whole life, you know, he showed great appreciation again inside my heart. And so I could see the letters between them, and I could see the original letter, the original critique of Howell that my father wrote, to which Alan, on a very long bus ride, said, "You're totally off base. That's not what it's about. Here's what it's about." And he wrote like a 13-page letter writing. That letter is at Dartmouth. And you know, so that kind of thing was really fascinating just to see some of those.
I read
and
that.
then
No, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was saying, I read that poem, and I'm you had to read it quite a few times, I think, totally maybe to get to understand just what it's about. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Other than it was a rant, you know, first line to the last line.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's an incredible poem. And I guess, you know, for those who want to take the time to study it and everything, it's obviously one of the best known poems ever. But then another thing was, like, my father did have affairs out of his marriage, and the longest affair, which lasted for 10 years and was carried on right in front of the family, all of the correspondence between his lover and him are in the archives. And when I found that, I was just, first of all, I was stunned to think that anybody would do that.
Yeah.
And then I was kind of appalled and didn't really want to read through them. And I remember a very close friend of mine who might be on this call, Ellen, she who lives in Placidas, I mentioned to you.
Yes.
She and I would have wine after I would read these letters, you know, and I mean, I needed those wines, you know, those wine evenings with Ellen, because I was just like trying to process, what the hell does this mean? And why am I reading it? But then on the other hand, why wouldn't I read it? Because the affair was so confusing to us. It was, it, you know, I was just married. So I was beginning to have a serious relationship with someone. And the fact that my father was having this affair at wedlock and also just sort of carrying it on so publicly was an enigma to me. I just couldn't understand it. And so reading through the letters helped me understand it better at the same time that it made me incredibly mad. And I could see how badly he hurt my mom. You know, that was really hard to see.
But your father knew you were going to read these.
Well, he knew I was in his archives.
Right.
And I said to him at one point, I said, do you think I'm going to find any surprises? And he looked at me and he said, well, if you do, won't that be interesting? I don't know if he was making the connection between the fact that I would actually read those letters or not. He was, you know, in his 80s and maybe, you know, not quite as firm as he had been. I mean, he lived to be 102, so he was still pretty good shape until he was 95 or so. But anyway, no, I think it's more that this is sort of the narcissism in him, you know, that anything about him should be preserved. And it who knows, it might give a researcher some fascinating story later.
Yeah, it might.
I mean, I don't know. It's not, you know, this is why I want to burn all my journals.
Well, through the process and then the writing of the memoir, are there some things you hope that the reader will take away as you share so candidly and authentically about your life and your dad's life? From what you've discovered in the letters.
Right.
What do you hope we'll take away?
Well, I think one of the things I'll have to sort of preface with, you know, a pivotal experience in my life, which was that as much as my parents were wonderful people and I loved them dearly growing up and everything, I could see that there was sort of an underbelly in the family that nobody wanted to talk about. And being the observer and the listener, I intuited some things were going on. And my first example of that really was a caretaker at our summer cottage who, when I was six, treated me pretty roughly physically. And it was, I couldn't have articulated this really at the time, but I could see, and I mean, I viscerally took this in my body, that my father was protecting him, not me, you know, that he was not going to get kicked off the, you know, the farm. He was going to be there. And so that was sort of my first body clue that something was, that I wasn't really going to be protected by him. Then my mother had epilepsy, very difficult version of epilepsy. And so I couldn't really trust my father. And then I could trust her in some ways, and I adored her and had so much fun with her. But at the same time, she would seize regularly. And as a young kid, I'd often be with her on my own, and I would need to pull her out of a subway car or, and so I grew up fast, you know, sort of taking care of her, and doing whatever was needed to do so. That's a whole nother story, but in any case, I didn't really, she wasn't a confidant with, you know, mine really. And by the time I got to be sort of, early teens, I noticed my father was sort of looking at me differently than I wanted him to look at me. And I noticed that he was started kissing me on the lips instead of the cheek. And I was becoming more and more uncomfortable around him and just trying to stay out of the house. I have a really good high school friend who said, yeah, you just stayed at my house all the time. And I think that's, you know, I was just trying to stay away from him. And then eventually, after I came back from boarding school, he molested me in my bed when I was asleep. And I just shut down at that point. I just went completely silent. And so one thing I hope readers will take away, and it's certainly one thing I hear from hundreds and hundreds of women who have been in touch with me about the book, and men too, that abuse doesn't have to be, you know, horrific or violent or, you know, like super dramatic to have a long-term impact on you. And, you know, it's a power issue. And my father had the power. And in some ways, when I look at it now, sort of with a clear-eyed adult head on, I think a lot of parents have trouble with their kids sort of becoming adults, you know, and I think in some way, this was a way of sort of putting me in my place a little bit. I don't think it was conscious. We'd been drinking. It was at a big, big party. There were 100 people in the house, and it was right after Ann Sexton won her Pulitzer Prize. So she was there having done a reading at Dartmouth, and big party afterwards, and I really liked my introduction with Anne, and I went up to bed innocently to go to sleep. And so I think, you know, I think that's one thing that I hope people will take away, that even this level of sexual abuse can have a profound impact on people and make a difference in the trajectory of their lives. I think the other thing that I hope people will take away is that, we get to own our own truth. And it took me a long time to come to the place where I said this to my dad's doctor when he died, that I didn't need anybody else to change their story of my father. They could adore him and whatever they wanted was fine with me, but I was no longer willing to change mine. And I felt like I had changed mine for many years, at my own cost, and to protect him and my family. And I don't regret that I did that exactly. And I don't beat myself up for that at all, but I do feel like, people have a right to own their own stories. And, I think we can all learn from them.
Yeah. So. Gretchen, thank you so much for sharing what you shared tonight. I'm looking at a clock I wish I didn't have to look at right now. Can you tell us quickly where listeners can find you, follow you? I know you have a new book coming out. Just tell us where they can go to find out about you.
Sure. Yeah. My website is www.gretchencharrington.com. The name is spelled correctly on screen, so there is only one R in Charrington. All one word.com. And yeah, you'll see pictures of all the famous poets, and you'll get a sense of what I'm up to next.
We really appreciate it. We will have you back when in the fall, when the next book is out. I know for sure we're going to want to have you back for sure. I'm just going to really quickly say next week, our guest is Deborah Thomas, and this is her current book, but she's got a new one coming that we'll be talking about, Josie and Vic. And also joining us next week is Henry Park, the film editor for True West Magazine, who's with us the first Thursday of every month. Jim, you have a very, very quick quote.
Oh, my goodness. I'm going to read two.
No, you only have time for one.
I might have time. Your only job as a writer is to tell the truth. Now, this is from a fellow Pulitzer Prize winning poet, Richard Eberhardt.
I know, right? That's the perfect quote.
Okay, you have another, and then we really have to go.
Well, this is one of my favorite guys, Robert Frost, which you knew.
Yeah.
Writing free verse is like playing tennis with a net down. And of course, your father didn't believe in free verse. He liked to have, you know, the couplets and the sonnets and everything in order.
Oh, right. Gretchen, this was great fun. I really appreciate it.
Likewise for me. Thank you so much to both of you.
Tonight. Thank you.
So thank until you. We see you again next week, remember,
it's always a great day out west.
You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.